WNHHLP 103.5 FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Mubaraka Ibrahim, and this is Mornings with Mubaraka on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, streaming live from Beaver Hills in New Haven, Connecticut, and also live on TuneIn Radio. .com and the app, as well as newhavenindependent.org. I want to welcome you to the show today, and I want to welcome my guest, Dr. Janice Lucky. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So today we are going to be talking about a topic that's pretty serious and a topic that I think that is not talked about enough, for sure. A topic that's not talked about enough. So September was Suicide Awareness Month, and we are on October 2nd, but it is important enough to actually continue to talk about it. Hopefully, as we have these months that come about, that is just the start of kind of like bringing people attention to something. So Janice, I thought that it was really, you have a book coming out.
Yes.
And the name really struck me because we hear it a lot. Right? So in my mind, I was thinking to myself, like, this show is really about when you are too blessed to be stressed, but you really are depressed.
Yes.
So I'm like, for sure, that is definitely a topic we need to talk about. So tell me, I always like to start my show off with the guest just telling a little bit about the guest first, and then kind of like talking a little bit about who you are. It helps people, I think, get a better grasp of why things are so important and how we find the things that we know that we can make a difference in our life. So first, I'd like to share a little bit about Janice. So Janice is a, she's a therapist. Am I using the right terminology?
Yes.
And she is the owner of Rubicon Center for Counseling and Wellness, as well as Jordan's Health and Wellness, which is a nonprofit that focuses on middle school children with chronic illness, as well as homelessness among adolescents. She has a PhD in educational psychology with a focus on counselor's education and an MS in community counseling. You have a practice in
North Haven, Connecticut.
And are you from the area? Are you from Connecticut?
I am from Connecticut. I grew up in West Haven.
Oh, okay. All right. Awesome. And so tell me a little bit about your upbringing, because that was a large part of your story. Your parents
They were ministers. And my mom, Mary Lucky, was an evangelist. My dad was a minister. And they were 22 years apart. And so he met my mom, and she had two kids, and then they had three together. So I have a very large extended family because my dad was married before. So I've more recently, over the past years, have really connected with family from my dad's side. And so they grew up in the church. And so my mom had this idea that you were just too blessed to be depressed. So I feel like she never felt like mental health really existed. My dad, on the other hand, I believe he was just more open to stuff, but he's from the deep south, so no one was really talking about mental illness. Plus, he's a man, so it was very different for him. But I remember growing up and us having feelings about, you know, sadness and things like that, and my mother would say, like, you have a roof over your head, you have food in your stomach, nobody's sick, nobody's ill, you're too blessed to be depressed. And we would constantly visit churches, and you would always hear that running theme, like, you're too blessed to be depressed, you're too blessed to be depressed, you're too blessed. And so it was really driven home to us in our heads and within our family. And I believe that my sisters, as well as myself, we all suffered from depression. And looking at my mother's family, there was a history of mental illness in my mom's family. And I'm not really sure about my dad's family in terms of, you know, mental illness. So
was it diagnosed mental illness, or something that you reflect on now that you are a therapist?
I think growing up, there was definitely, you could see that there was something going on. We didn't really know what to call it or what it was because we weren't really introduced to this whole ideology of mental illness. Back then, people were using the word mental retardation, or, you know, those were the terminologies that we heard. Or if someone, you know, acted a little strange, such and such is crazy. Because, you know, right, and there was really, so that whole idea of mental illness just was not prevalent in our home. It was not a word that you heard at all. And I think growing up in a Christian faith, it wasn't something that was grasped either, that even existed.
So not only in your immediate family, but your extended family didn't really like talk about mental illness as well?
No.
So as a child, how were you taught to deal with different types of feelings that you were having that just, you know, made you sad, or were you given any coping skills at all?
No, it was, you need to pray, read your Bible. When you hear that as a kid, I don't know if anybody has ever read, you know, King James, the King James version of the Bible, like, it's difficult for adults to grasp and read it with spiritual interpretation versus a literal interpretation. Mm. And so we were told, you just need to pray. Take your Bible, go pray. And I'm laughing because When I had kids and I started bringing them to church, you know, we had teen Bibles. I bought them teen Bibles, which,
really?
You know, they were, you know, written so that they were stories so that teens, we didn't have that. We were reading straight up the regular adult
really?
King James version. You know, now they have all these different versions, the NIV, the new NIV, and, you know, where everyone's trying to break down these scriptures. But we were reading the King James version, and we would sit there and my mother would be like, pray, you just need to pray. Mm-hmm. And so it was really hard because I struggled with feeling sad. And I had a sister who one time actually went to a school counselor. And I remember my mother like losing her mind because I guess laws around confidentiality were very different at that time. Mm-hmm. So I remember the woman must have had called my mother on the phone, and I heard my mother flipping out, you know, house business. And I'm sure my sister was just like...
And how old was your sister at this point?
She might have been in middle school.
Okay, and how old were you?
I was probably in elementary, because we're about 2 years apart. Okay. But my mother flipped out. Like, she didn't want her talking to them. You don't tell those people, you just need to pray. So
do you remember if your sister was she going to the counselor because she was feeling sad? Because
I don't remember what was said. We never discussed it, but I heard my mother like really losing her mind about talking about stuff. You know, we were all growing up in an African American family. We were taught, you know, house business is house business. So if anything went on in the house, if there was any kind of struggles, and say, you know, as a kid, you were told or you overheard something and it began to stress you out and you weren't allowed. And we grew up with this ideology that kids should be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. So not only did you not voice your opinion about your feelings, if you overheard something, you had to kind of process it in whatever mind you were in at that time. And kids process things. So middle childhood, kids process things in a very literal term. And so there's no gray areas. So, you know, I always tell people, you know, with domestic violence, they'll say, oh, you know, the kids never hurt us. And I'm like, well, if they, you know, they never seen us. And I said, well, if they heard you, then their mental pictures are going to be very different. Mm-hmm. They're going to make up a mental picture to go along with whatever they heard. Mm-hmm. Or even the aftermath if they've, so it's the same thing if there were struggles going on in the home. Kids are like, oh my God, are we going to be homeless or this, that, and the third? Because middle age is very, very literal. They hear something and there is no shades of gray that parents are working it out financially. And so I'm not sure what my sister said, but...
Your mother didn't like whatever she said.
Whatever it was, you went to a counselor, you talked to a counselor. Mm-hmm. And so my mother, if someone was getting in trouble, you knew it. You know, the other siblings knew it, and you knew whatever it was she did, I'm not going to do it. So it kind of made us all like go back in a shell, you know, and get smaller and smaller and smaller, that, you know, we're told we shouldn't be, we should only be seen and not heard. Mm. So that concept kind of drove home.
How many siblings do you have?
I have three sisters and I have one brother who passed.
Okay. So growing up, they were, you were all kind of like taught that same philosophy.
That same mentality, that same philosophy.
Now, you said, you were telling me that you kind of struggled a little bit with depression when you were young.
I did struggle with depression really bad, feeling sad a lot and thinking there was something wrong with me for feeling this way. And it wasn't anything earlier on in the earlier years. There was no trauma. But I remember, one, always being an anxious kid. I was a bedwetter. And then in, I remember in it was preschool, kindergarten, I would cry the whole time I would go. And I remember them saying to my mom, you could send her, but we're just going to sit her in a corner. Like, she cries the whole time. And there was even a time I remember my sister, who's 2 years older than me, we're really, really close. And they would go get her out of her classroom and be like, could you calm her down?
Do you think that that was because you had anxiety?
I think it was a lot of anxiety. And my mother would chalk it up as she's used to being with her sister, she's spoiled. And so...
So that brings a really interesting question as to, like, when is it that you should be kind of, like, concerned that a kid is just opposed to crying a lot because they're, quote-unquote, spoiled, as opposed to what are some of the signs for younger kids that they might be dealing with anxiety or depression and they just don't have the words for that?
And so I think one of the things is you try to rule out everything else. So that's how we do it in this field. You know, if you tell me your kid is doing X, Y, and Z, excessive bedwetting, like, you know that your kid has no medical issues, there was no early trauma, and this kid is still bedwetting. That's usually a sign of some type of nervousness.
And so bedwetting isn't necessarily uncommon, so at what point does it become a concern? Like, and I've, of course, this has always been an interesting question to me, like, when is it okay? Like, okay, this is just a part of childhood versus... okay, this is a concern.
Well, I felt it probably should have been a concern with me because I wet the bed or struggled with it a long time when other kids weren't, and I wasn't wet during the day. It was only at night. And so something like that, you would say, okay, is there any problem with the kid? Does the kid have just a smaller bladder?
Okay. So when you say a lot, what age?
I probably still had some episodes probably into middle school.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's kind of like you're getting older, but you're still having issues. Right. So should parents be concerned if they have, or start at least trying to rule out if kids are still wetting the bed by middle school?
Right. Absolutely. And I just think even if they're younger, you should at least check them out and make sure with the pediatrician that there's no medical reason. So before we go to the mental health side, we look at, okay, this can't be explained by a medical reason. Does a kid just have a smaller bladder? Does a kid have a weak bladder? You know, there are different things that can be tested. And that was one of the, you know, things that were never done. In terms of the crying, it was almost like if I wasn't in my own circle, even though I knew these kids, I could go outside and play in the neighborhood. So why didn't I cry when I went out with these same kids? Why was school such an issue for me? But I remember crying and crying and crying. And I remember talking to myself like, you're going to be okay. You know, I remember as young as a kid, because I didn't want to be like that. I didn't want to be the outlier in the classroom. And I say, you're going to be, I would talk to myself in my head. And even into first grade, I remember moments of nervousness that this was a new school year, and, you know, and I remember saying, okay, you're not going to cry. I don't ever remember when I got the crying under control. I know by first grade I definitely wasn't doing it, but I know that feeling, there were times where I was still really trying to...
That anxiety was still there.
Yeah, I was still trying to talk to myself and say, you're going to be okay, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay, you know.
And did that... Did those feelings of anxiety exacerbate as you got older, or how did you deal with it as you got older?
I think there was always a level of nervousness there. But as I got older, you know, I really gravitated toward education. And so that was one thing that I kind of, I call that my walking on water thing, is I knew I was smart. And so I like school. I like to learn. So that wasn't.
So the crying and the anxiety of going to school was not about you not wanting to do the work.
No.
It was about you physically being there and being in that environment.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, just, you know, being in an environment, I guess, that was unknown to me.
Oftentimes people, well, today we hear a lot of stories about children who are bullied at school or mistreated. Was that kind of like an issue for you at all?
There were times where I could be the one that gets singled out. And I almost, one of the things I tell my clients is that whatever's living in on the inside of you, you are going to attract that. So if there is an insecurity or fear, you know, I always tell people thoughts are things. You don't even have to speak it. You know, speaking it is even worse. But thoughts are things. And so even if that's living inside of you, you are going to attract what is living inside of you. And knowing that now, being in this field and as an adult, I realized I was so insecure about myself. I was overweight. And so I got made fun of at home. About peeing in the bed, about being overweight, about eating too much. And so if there was any kid that could get picked on the bus, it would be me. I remember some older kids, even being in high school, laughing at me and saying, oh, she's got a mustache and this, that, and the third. And I remember me going home shaving it. Well, you know, if you shave it, it's coming back.
Even thicker.
And I remember, like, trying to sneak and get a razor to shave it because I'm like, oh, my God, I got. And I might not have even had a mustache, but these were just the older kids,
right,
the upperclassmen being cool. And so I remember being so insecure about what I looked like, about. And you got to realize, like, when kids are starting to form self-esteem, I was a big baby. So my nickname, even at birth, was like, oh, big baby, fat baby. Well, when a kid isn't, when they're starting to establish their identity and self-esteem and who they are, if you're still calling them big baby and fat baby, it begins to resonate that I'm obese, that I'm different, that I'm, and I think those little nicknames weren't, in the beginning they were more terms of endearment, but I don't think people understand when you're still calling your kid that,
right?
You know, right. That, and you know, your friends and church family and things like that, that you really start to think, because my sister was tiny. She was very, very tiny. My sister that was 2 years older than me. And so her nickname was like Doll Baby and Squirrel. Like the big joke was that she was so tiny that, you know, if you put her out there on a kite, she might fly away.
As opposed to you that was Big Baby.
Yeah, I can hold her down.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Mubaraka Ibrahim, and this is Mornings with Mubaraka, streaming live from the Beaver Hill section of New Haven, Connecticut. And today we have on the show Dr. Janice Olucky. We're talking about mental health for children in particular, and particularly in African American and religious families. So one of the things that you talked about is often that in a Christian family that, you know, you're too blessed to be depressed, but it's something that is not just isolated to Christianity. Growing up in a religiously Muslim family, depression wasn't a real thing. Muslims pretty much deal with it Many Muslims, not all, is becoming a little bit more acceptable for people to actually recognize mental health and get treatment for it. But in every religion, pretty much deals with it the same way, have a history of dealing with it the same way. Like, okay, go pray.
Right.
Like, you're depressed because you aren't giving your problems to God. It's your fault because, you know, you're trying to solve it yourself. Just give it to God.
Right.
And it doesn't work that way when it is a true mental health issue.
Right.
So your depression got pretty
pretty serious for you, where you actually tried to not be here anymore.
Right. And I remember being young. I might have been, it was after my mom and dad got divorced. And I remember just feeling really, really sad. By this point, I clearly had some serious self-esteem issues.
And how old were you at this point?
I might have been about 10 or 11, so still in middle childhood. And remember I told you, that's where their mindset is, to think literally. There's no shades of gray. They can't really kind of process things any different way. And so I remember saying, I used to have allergies. And if we ate something and had an allergic reaction, I remember my mother with, you know, the Benadryl, the pink and white pills. I didn't know what they were called at the time. But I remember, you know, she'd give you a Benadryl or something, a bug bite or something, you're itching. She, you know, that was the thing, Benadryl. And so I remember every time I would take Benadryl, I get really tired, knockout. And so I got to the point of my mother kept them on her dresser in this little container, which I don't know why she ever took them out the bottle, but it was a whole bunch of them in this container. And it was like an Avon container that she washed out. And so I remember thinking, if one of these will make me sleep, as long as, you know, I thought I was sleeping when I would take them, I'm like, a whole handful would not allow me to wake up. And I remember taking a whole handful and laying on a couch. I don't know why the couch. We had this like a gold color couch with plastic, because back in the days, everybody put plastic on everything. And so I remember laying on the couch thinking, I'm not going to wake up. And this will be, all of these problems will be gone. And I remember at some point, someone must have got me up to go to bed or whatever the case is, because I woke up the next morning in my bed thinking, God, why am I still here? Mm. Why am I still here?
Do you remember the things that were going on to you in your life that was just so overwhelming you didn't want to be? It was the teasing. Was there other things going on that you just like really just didn't want to be there?
I think it was just, I just felt sad and I didn't know what it was connected to. That sadness came before like the teasing came in school. And so there was a lot of teasing at home as well. And I knew my sisters and brothers loved me, but it was just an atmosphere, and my mother struggled financially. And so I just remember saying, I just don't want to be here. I just want to sleep. And I think that's a lot of times with young kids, many people will tell you, see a lot about adolescent suicide and, you know, people dealing with depression and, you know, stars, you know, taking their lives or overdosing. But I don't think there's a lot. You don't hear a lot about when a child does it. And I think sometimes it's because people don't realize why that kid died or what happened to that kid. Younger kids are more apt to run out in the street in front of cars, which, think about it, if a kid ran out in the street and got hit, you're thinking that kid wasn't paying attention.
You don't think that it was on purpose.
Right. And so I think that middle age group is definitely different. You're going to look for, you know, is my child more anxious? Is my child a nail biter? Is your kid biting their nails? Do you look at your kid's nails and notice that they're chewing on things? And that's a sign of nervousness. You know, it becomes almost a habit. And most of the time, the kids don't even know that they're doing it.
What are some of the other signs that parents should be aware of? Because I think that what makes that age particularly difficult for parents and caregivers is that middle school is also the age where kids start shutting down. They stop telling parents as much as what's going on. What are ways or signs that parents can look for at that age?
And like I said, one of them, you know, is definitely the bedwetting, the nail biting, any habits that you see that might be excessive. And we always try to rule out the medical stuff. So like those pica behaviors, which, you know, sometimes kids will put things that shouldn't be in their mouth, non-food items in their mouth. Sometimes that can be different types of deficiencies. So that's why we always want to make sure, if we see that behavior, that we're not just saying, oh my God, my kid is depressed, let me take him to a therapist, but more so, let me rule out this medical thing. Because pica behaviors can be
So would the first step as a parent would be take them to their pediatrician first?
Right.
And express all of this, all of the things that you've noticed?
Right.
And the pediatrician can be able to rule out any medical reasons.
Right. And usually they'll send them for blood work or, you know, different laboratory tests. The other thing is aggression. Sometimes you have kids that become very, very aggressive. Kids that don't seem to be, like, socially meshing with other kids. Mm. So there could be, you know, different things going on. Even with the severe hyperactivity, you got to make sure that you're not dealing with a kid with ADHD.
So it actually sounds very difficult.
It does. And that's why, like you said, this age is just, that middle age group is tough. Mm-hmm. It's really tough.
Now, after you tried to put yourself to sleep, did you tell anybody?
No, never told anybody.
And so,
never told anybody, didn't get sick. No, because I thought, and it's funny because I always think, you know, me and God have this relationship where he realizes that I'm a joke sometimes, because I was just like thinking like, man, I can't even get this right. Like, I better stop. You know, my thought was I better stop, because what if I, you know, don't follow through, but then I impair myself. And one of the things that I really gravitated toward, like I said, my walk on water thing, self-esteem wise, was academics. I knew I was smart. And even at that age, it somehow, I remember saying to myself, like, what if I'm just stuck in this world and I can't function? Mm-hmm. And all I have is my brain. I thought to myself, all I have is my, like, the one part of me that I love is my brain. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped. I did have another episode when I was a young parent where I felt like it, but by then I had kids and I was like, who are going to take care of these kids? They only have me. So, you know, and that kind of passed. And
So after your attempt when you were 11, how did you handle your depression as an adolescent? Or did it just gradually get better?
It didn't gradually get better. I think I began to just cope. I was an emotional leader, but because there were all these eating issues at home where I was kind of berated for either overeating or, you know, being heavy, I would cope by, like, sneaking to eat, or I couldn't go in the cafeteria. I hated the cafeteria in high school. I remember hating the cafeteria in high school. I didn't like crowds. You know, I wouldn't make eye contact with people. I'd grab my books. And I had friends. I wasn't the in crowd. And I had some friends that were in the in crowd. You know, they were the cool kids. My sister that's 2 years older than me, very, very bright. And so we were in high school together at the same time, where my brother and my other sister, my middle sister, they were in high school at the same time. And so, but my sister that's 2 years older than me, she was with, like, the honor roll kids, this, that, and the third, you know. I just kind of never fit in anywhere. But I had friends, but it was just like I would isolate. I did a lot of isolating. Mm-hmm.
And so that's how you pretty much just coped and put your head in your books.
Right,
you could do
right.
That.
Yeah, I knew that was one thing that would never hurt me. It didn't make me feel bad. And like I said, it was the part of my self-esteem that I walked on water with.
So you've said that several times. Explain your concept of walk on water.
So
can everybody walk on water?
No. And so, you know, there's a scripture in the Bible where Jesus tells one of his disciples to get out the boat and to walk on water. And it's having that faith that, you know, God got you. And so for me, it was about, this is the part that I knew I had.
Okay.
Like, I knew that I could walk on that water and not,
deep faith in your ability to achieve.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That's good. We want to make sure, because I'm sure that somebody out there is like, what is she talking about? So now you know, when you have deep faith in something, that your complete self-efficacy and faith that you can achieve it, then you're walking on water. Awesome. So tell me a little bit about as you got older and you began to recognize that, you know, this was depression as a child, did you, like, talk to your family about it? Did you tell them, like, this is what I was going through?
No, I did not. I did not. It wasn't until, ironically enough, it wasn't until my mom passed where I couldn't, usually I had been strong, and it was just like, when things had to be done or whatever, I was a sister, like, I was going to fully execute it, you know? And so when she passed, I was like, okay, I have to get this funeral stuff together, this, that, and a third, be strong. But I had a lot of things going on at the time. I had a new child, a new marriage. The job was just so stressful. And it was just a lot of, and I was working on my, I was supposed to be working on my dissertation. I'd finished all the classwork, all the coursework, but then my mom passed. So it was like, ooh, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. So that was when I really, I think, emotionally hit rock bottom. Because over the years, I had gotten really, really spiritual in my faith. Okay. I always say, you know, my mother had 5 kids. And, you know, we were all brought up the same way. And I'm one of the ones who really, even though I didn't like what I seen in church, I didn't like sometimes the hypocrisy in terms of the messages that were given in man-made religion and organized religion, I knew me and my higher power were very, very connected. Mm. So I built upon that over the years, even though there were times that I was depressed. Typically, I could meditate and get myself out of it, you know, and talk myself out of it. And so that was my coping skill. But when everything kind of piled on me, I fell apart, and I was just like, I was still going to work. I was still functioning because, you know, we still have to pay the bills. But it was my doctor that noticed. She was like, oh, how's that dissertation coming? Are you almost done? You should be done by now. And we're talking like this was almost maybe 4 or 5 years after my mother died. Mm. I literally had done the last classes and never went back. And so, and was registering because I had to register. You had to register every year saying you were like doing research. Well, before you get to research, you should have known what you were supposed to be researching. And you would have had that conversation with the chair of your department. And I was just like, well, whatever. I'll just keep, you know, keep active. And she says, are you almost done? I was like, oh, I kind of gave that up. And she was like, what? And she began to talk to me, and she says, Jan, I want to write you this script, and I think this would be very, very helpful, because I used to tell her how overwhelming work was. And I said, I'm not taking an antidepressant. Are you kidding? What's wrong with you? I'm not taking this. You know, my clients take this. And I remember saying to my sister, because we go to the same doctor, I said, you know, Dr. Wingo gave me this prescription, and she said, oh, yeah, I've had that. Da, da, da. So me and 2 of my sisters had talked, and I never knew that they had sought help after they left my mom's house or as adults. And they were like, oh, yeah, this, that, and the third. And I was like, how come you guys never said anything? But it makes sense. We grew up like that. It was a taboo in the house to have feelings of anything other than happiness. Mm. And so nobody talked about it. And when I think that was the point that I broke down to really cry, that, wow, we couldn't even have this conversation until my mother passed.
So you and your sisters were all, you all sought mental health, but never really told the other person that you were seeking help.
I did, because I'm transparent. Listen, I was like, by the way, they want to give me this pill, and I know it's an antidepressant, and blah, 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 blah. I'm very transparent. Mm. That's the only thing I've learned over the years that has gotten me through sometimes with trauma and, you know, the bullying, the stuff at home, was for me to just get it out my system.
So talk to me a little bit about kind of like, what are some of the changes that we can make as parents, as communities, as just in helping young people cope emotionally. Because, you know, statistics, when I was researching for this show, the statistics are showing that, you know, not only is suicide increasing, but particularly among Black children, the rate of suicide. Because there was a time it was like, oh, that's white people's stuff.
Right.
White
right.
people commit suicide. White people go to the psychologists and therapists. Like, Black people don't do that.
Right.
It's changing. In the last 3-5 years, you can see a lot more talk about it, a lot more consciousness just in general on social media and having conversations and conferences. It's becoming less of a taboo. But my fear is that it has become almost like a catchphrase where it's very surface. Are Black people just talking about mental health, or are they actually seeking help?
So I will say that definitely Black people are definitely seeking mental health. Mm-hmm. I'm on all the different insurance panels to see people for counseling and be paid through their insurances. And I remember about a year or so back when I decided to do my practice full time, that the minute I got on Magellan's Yale Health panel, a flood of people of color, all different colors, started coming in. And was just like literally soon as I put my picture up there.
So not just seeking help, but they're seeking help from Black therapists.
From Black therapists. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, wow, like, what is this? Mm-hmm. And they were like, you know, typically I wouldn't go to a therapist. And I was like, wow. So people knew that they needed help, but didn't feel comfortable if the person didn't look like them. Mm-hmm. Or wasn't a person of color that they couldn't understand their struggle. And so I was just like, wow, this is really increasing. But I think you're absolutely right. When we talk about people, it was like, that's a white thing. You don't kill yourself. Black people don't kill themselves. We've gone through slavery and struggles and we're a strong race and this and that. But, you know, and I always tell people what they don't understand is, even though we are resilient. It just is what it is. And I do believe that we carry a level of resiliency that may be higher than, you know, other cultures because of our struggle and what we've had to overcome. And it's kind of been passed down generationally. But what's also been passed down generationally has been histories of trauma. I mean, there was a lot of abuse going on in the South. You know, when you see these movies that depict, you know, what Southern life was like, you know, years ago in the 50s and the 60s, where people just didn't tell, there was a lot of molestation going on. That's trauma.
Yeah.
So trauma is going to, you know, how do we get to a mental health state? Sometimes genetically, our bodies just don't produce certain hormones that we need to keep us up. This is why exercise, when people exercise, those endorphins, they're like, you know, people will often say to me, well, when I can get to the gym, when I can go to the gym, I always feel better. Mm-hmm. It's those endorphins. That means your body's probably not producing enough of something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one way where you could see, we could just be hardwired differently.
Right.
But then there's also situational depression, anxiety, things like that. So there's that chemical component. And so if we look at it from that aspect, I wouldn't tell my diabetic son, we're just going to pray, don't take your insulin, eat all that sugar you want, you're going to be fine. We're going to pray that your blood sugar, you know, stays where it needs to be, and that your pancreas just continues to work in the name of Jesus. You know, and so
it's funny because I've literally heard people say that. Like, right. I'm not, my doctor said I have diabetes, but I'm not going to claim that.
I'm not going to lie. I will not claim type 1. I am praying.
You claim diabetes, though.
Definitely diabetes there.
Right.
I'm not claiming type 1 because I'm like, dude, we are going to pray for healing that your pancreas continues to produce insulin. Even though diabetes
But you're going to take the steps, right?
We're going to take the steps. You know, I'm on it, you know. His blood sugar comes over on my phone, you know.
All right. Good.
So, and I always tell people, you wouldn't tell a diabetic or you wouldn't tell a cancer patient, if there was a cure, you wouldn't tell them, don't take that. Right. We're just going to pray for healing. And don't get me wrong. There's been a lot, like you said, there's more stuff now that you see on social media. I've actually seen different different groups and different faiths, you know, kind of posting their sermons and stuff on the net, where I, maybe about a year ago, I seen a gentleman said, you know, you can pray to God for healing for the depression and go to a therapist at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my goodness, it's got to the black church. Like, they're getting it. You know, that these things do exist. And, you know, I always, when people say, oh, you know, I'm too blessed to be depressed, and they're, you know, saying, well, my higher power and this, that, and the third, and it doesn't matter who their higher power is, I always say, oh, okay, well, who do you thought created this doctor who came out with this medication? And, like, you think that idea just came from anywhere? Like, just like, you know, he has the power to heal you, he, she, whomever has the power to heal you, what about to find you the cure for that? And what if that cure is in medication or some type of therapy? And so that always messes people up. I let them take that back and kind of sit with them and just really try to think about and try to process that whole thought, that it could be, what if it's a chemical thing? And your body's just not working properly, or you were just hardwired differently. What if those situations that you've been through of trauma, you're still walking around with them, and now you have so much heavy that you can't unload any of this stuff, and now you're breaking down, and now you can't function in all your areas of life.
So we have just a few minutes left to the show. It goes by so quickly.
It does.
It really does. What are some of the things that you want to leave our listeners with pertaining to, particularly paying attention to the mental health of your children?
I would say look for those signs. You know, there are these average things that, you know, people have coined. This is the average behavior of kids. Also, too, family history. You don't know how many people I get that say there's no family history of mental illness. That's one of the questions that I ask. And so I really have to break it down and say, you know, has there ever been a time where you've seen your parents isolate more? Have you seen your parents cry more? Or, you know, and then they start describing their parents' relationship, or some things, you know, there were times where my mother was just crazy, or whatever the case is. And I'll say, what did that look like? You know, were there any substance abuse issues within the family? Because before there's substance abuse issues, substance abuse issues are medicating for something.
Right. People always, and I think that that is also very common, that we look at substance abuse as the issue, but it's not the issue. It's them trying to self-medicate for the issue.
Exactly.
It's very rarely the actual problem that people are having.
Exactly. And so situations, watch what we tell our kids. You can speak things into existence. You know, you call your kid lazy. You know, watch how you talk to your children and how it impacts, you know, their growth. You know, if you see a kid, sometimes these kids from, you know, little kids, you see them, they have a struggle with being with other kids, you know, as little as 5 or 6, like I said. And so you want to just watch your child and say, is this getting any easier for this child? You know, I had a parent who said, I raised all my kids, but I always knew, and her son, we had diagnosed him with schizophrenia, because there are things that won't get diagnosed until after the kid turns 18. But she said he was always different. And she described these behaviors. A lot of things in kids, they'll say they're just being oppositional. Mm-hmm. Okay, but what's behind that? Because for younger kids, they look at the behaviors. The aggression, the sadness, the crying, the isolation. You know, are they doing more things to get attention, and they just love negative attention? They don't care.
You know, what's really interesting is that when you talk about the aggression in particular, oftentimes we focus on, I feel like today, there's such a huge focus on bullying, and we are looking at the kid who's being bullied, But it sounds like we really need to look at the bully. They themselves exactly. may be having the issues of depression or anxiety or things like that.
Absolutely.
So, thank you so much. Before we go, I always like to make sure that if someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, I have a website, www.askdrlucky.com. And so most of my information is there. They can also, there's a phone number there that they can call or they can email me.
And everything is on the website.
Everything is on the website.
AskDrLucky.com. Well, yes. Thank you for joining me, and thank you guys for listening.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Mubaraka Ibrahim, and as I remind you each week, go about your week to be a voice and not an echo. Until next week.